Welcome to the Not Unreasonable Podcast. I'm your host, David Wright, an actuary and reinsurance broker. This is a show of interviews with people who have something to teach us about managing our businesses and ourselves. There's a lot to learn out there, folks, so let's get to work. This show is brought to you by Beach, where I work and have worked my entire career. We are a global reinsurance intermediary, and we pride ourselves on creative thinking, deep analysis, and client service. Those three qualities are actually intimately related because you can't spend the energy digging deep into a problem unless you really care about the client. We find that when you really do understand the problem, the solution becomes obvious, even if it seems a little bit unorthodox to the outside world at first. The nature of insurance is to take solutions we know and trust and try to force them onto the problems of the day. We just don't settle for that. You can see further at beachgp.com. In this interview, we talk a bit about the insurance cycle without actually really discussing what it is. Reinsurance people are just completely obsessed with it. And for good reason. Vast fortunes have been won and lost during these cyclical turns. Hard markets are times when prices are rising and the market for pretty much every insurance and reinsurance product shrinks. In those times, some companies can generate extraordinary profit margins. Others fail, of course, which is the point. There's lots of uncertainty. Hard markets are pretty rare, so the norm is for the market to be what we call soft. And it's maybe an amusing observation that insurance companies like to complain about the soft market because in those environments, they actually have to compete with each other. One way of thinking about reinsurer strategy is simply to write business in a hard market and don't write it in a soft market. That is a bit simplistic and unsatisfying, so one of the themes of this show is to better understand what reinsurer strategy is. Joe, of course, does a great job on that question when I asked it in our interview. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe in your favorite app, rate it on iTunes, and you can also sign up for periodic short updates on content I produce, including these shows, at webtrough, webtrough.com/signup. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Joe Taranto. My guest today is Joe Taranto, chairman of Everest Re. Joe is CEO as well until 2014, having been in that role for 20 years, growing the company from $500 million to about $6 billion in premium volume. Joe started his career as an actuary at AIG in 1975. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David.
So I'd like to actually, we'll start a little bit kind of nearer to the end of your CEO-ship. Now, you were CEO and chairman, and you stepped away from the CEO role, which is a kind of retirement, I guess, semi-retirement maybe, so certainly you still have a full-time job there. But I heard a piece of advice once was attributed to you, and the advice was that if you don't retire by the time you're 65, you're never going to retire. And I'm wondering if you think of it as a retirement, and obviously for somebody, you know, as accomplished as you are, you're no doubt a very hard and dedicated worker and, you know, required a lot of sacrifice through your life. So how does it feel to actually step away a little bit from the grind? And what made you want to do that? Well, not everybody does, right?
It's interesting to hear that quote come back at me, and it's accurate. I met somebody once that was retiring, and they told me that they wanted to retire before they were too old to retire. And I had to think about that for a while as to what that meant until I finally got it, that if you go too long at one thing, you kind of just don't know anything else. And so having had a wonderful active and career, I finally just wanted to give myself a chance to do some other things. But staying on as chairman was perfect for me because it really is semi-retirement. It gives me a chance to continue with the company and with the friends I have and do a lot of the parts of the job that I used to enjoy doing, at the same time freeing me up to do a whole lot of new and different things.
And were you building up a bank of things you wanted to do through the time? Like, I mean, there's a mental kind of process as well as a, you know, formal responsibility. Is that something you've been looking forward to or apprehensive of?
I think for every person it's different. For me, there was some apprehension because I'd worked so long and so hard at what I'd done and enjoyed it that I knew it wasn't going to be simple to fill my time the way that I used to fill my time. And whereas there was a whole bunch of things that I wanted to get into, there were still empty spaces in the beginning, and I kind of figured that would be the case. But as time's gone on, I've learned how to fill in those spaces with more and more enjoyable things, but still keep the stuff within the world, the business world that I like to do, active.
And what would you say are some of the things you take the most satisfaction from? Because I think about one of the challenges that surprises most, certainly surprised me through my progression, was how hard it is to manage and build a business. You know, looking from the outside, you sort of imagine, oh, I could do better than that guy. but once you get in the chair, you're like, well, this is pretty tough. And you've had a series of management roles. I mean, you've been in management as opposed to kind of on the ground, say, an actuarial work or execution for, you know, for, gosh, 30 years or so as you took the helm at TransRe. What did it feel like when you kind of ascended into that role of CEO-ship then, you know, within AIG at Transatlantic and finally had to, you know, tackle the problems for the first time?
Well, I'd say, first of all, it's more like 40 years in management, but it's been great. And, you know, when you get into what's most satisfying, obviously the success and the building process and, you know, being able to show for investors and for the rest of the world that you've made money and you've achieved goals is wonderful. But for me, I think just dealing with the people was always the most satisfying. Building a group, the camaraderie, the team, the spirit, enjoying successes together, seeing some young people develop where you knew they had tremendous potential and just bringing them along. To me, forming those relationships, that was just so satisfying, so enjoyable.
You know, one of the things I observed a little while ago, I think, was that there was quite a lot of industry leaders that emerged from that actuarial department at AIG in the kind of late 70s, let's say. I wonder if you feel the same way, and if that's the case, what was it that was going on there? Was there somebody who was an early leader there that developed many of you and your generation, or was it you? I know you managed that department as well. Perhaps you can take some credit.
Well, there was quite a few of us that did very well from the actuarial department at AIG and from other departments at AIG. AIG was rather unique in and of itself. But, yeah, Steve Newman was the guy that hired myself and a bunch of the others at AIG. He went on to do very well. Brian Duperreault was one of the people that interviewed me and was
really
involved with hiring of me at AIG. And we worked together and became and are still very, very good friends. But it was a great atmosphere. It was a place where you got tremendous responsibility if you deserved it. It was a place where actuaries weren't just actuaries, if you will. They were considered business people, and they really were expected to help with the business and grow the business. And they were used by Hank Greenberg and others in ways that many other companies just weren't using actuaries in those days. So it was a great education, and it was a great place to start our career.
Hey, what would you say would be a way that actuaries were used differently than at AIG as opposed to someplace else?
Well, I think in those days, and I'm going back to the 70s now, when I first started, actuaries were most involved with reserving. Many of them weren't even involved with the pricing side. They weren't involved with reinsurance placements. They weren't involved with the business decisions. They weren't involved with capital management. I could go on. The list really does go on. And AIG was one of the first places to say, well, we have some bright people that can, you know, think about the business side as well, perhaps in quantitative ways that other people aren't, and they have a great education here. Let's put it to use. And frankly, a lot of the people that Hank hired in those days were people that were not just good academically, but had some street smarts as well. And he just saw a way of, if they can do it and I can put them to use in this business world in a very practical way, let's do it.
I'm trying to kind of figure out what the difference might be about that culture as opposed to another one. Because, you know, maybe you don't have too much insight because you work there and then the only other companies you've been a part of are companies you've built. And so obviously you're trying to create something in that environment. I mean, how aware were you about what might exactly have been different about the culture there as opposed to other places?
I don't think I was that aware because I started as a pretty young guy. And at one point, you know, it was a pretty intense place. And years later, people would ask me, well, how do you work at this place? It's kind of a crazy place. And I would say, well, you mean every other place isn't like this?
Right, yeah.
So I just didn't know. But I ended up embodying many of the aspects of the culture at AIG. Let me talk a little bit about the culture of AIG because I do think it was rather unique. First of all, you learned about accountability there. If you could do your job and do it well and do more, you were given more responsibility. But if you couldn't do your job, you were gone. And there was direct talk there. If you messed up at something, you said you messed up at it, and you fixed it, and you got it right. And if you didn't get it right the next time, you were gone. There was total focus. There was no fuzzy mission statement. You know, we knew what the goals were. Be the best. Grow the business. Be profitable. And it was maybe the best meritocracy that I've ever seen in the way of a large company. If you could do more, you were given more. You didn't have to wait until you were gray-haired and 65 years old to get a very senior job. I was given the CEO of Transatlantic Re when I was 37 years old. I was put in charge of the actuarial department when I was 33 years old. This was just the way it was. It was, let's do what makes sense. The company was growing beyond belief. I start in 1975. It's a peanut of a company. Nobody even knows what AIG is. And I leave 19 years later, and it's the biggest, strongest, most powerful insurance company in the world. For 19 years, that's just an incredible change. And it made for tremendous opportunity that for those that had the ability and the and desire.
Well, I wonder what, because everything comes with a cost is one of the things that, you know, I've learned in life. And so, I mean, having a culture in retrospect is obvious that it was a good idea, right? So, I mean, you built an enormous company, and the things you're saying seem to me to be self-evident. Of course, you give people who are good some more responsibility and allow them to grow, because that's going to grow the firm. But there must be a downside somewhere. I mean, I guess you have to fire people, and that's unpleasant, I'm sure. And I wonder if there are people who are senior people who sort of felt it was their opportunity and were felt frozen out, some dissatisfaction. I mean, what are the kind of the political costs internally, or why aren't more companies like that? Is maybe one way of putting this.
Well, look, yes, sometimes you'd move too hard and too fast, and you'd find it might be a mistake, and you'd have to take a step back and regroup. I would say many companies today and companies going into the future are not going to ever replicate that model. In fact, that model seems somewhat insensitive
right.
today.
Okay.
and frankly, the world is, I think, becoming more sensitive to people's needs. So maybe it just worked for a time, and perhaps some ways on the human side at times it didn't work. And frankly, that did lead to some good people leaving throughout the years. But for that point in time, in terms of growth, you can just look at what happened for the company. I mean, the return to shareholders for that period was absolutely outrageous. And I will say, while you were working in this intense environment, you felt very proud of it. You actually were made to feel like you were the elite group. You were the Navy SEALs. You didn't want to work at any other company. You were outdistancing all these other companies by light years. And frankly, when I did go to visit some other companies and get to know other companies, they seemed very sleepy to me relative to AIG. As crazy and intense as AIG was, it was fun. We enjoyed it. And we worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We were constantly on the go. So it was very exciting, and that's really a lot of what was behind the culture of not to mention the intelligence and the good people at the top that led to the growth. But, yes, you don't get that kind of turbulent change without some downside.
Did it change who you were? I mean, were you somebody who was just sort of naturally attuned to that kind of environment, or do you feel like that helped to form some of who you are in other parts of your life?
It did to a degree. When I went into that environment, you know, I grew up in the streets of Brooklyn, so there was a certain amount of that I might have understood. But at times, it actually seemed kind of harsh and a little bit too much for me. I did learn that people have to do their job, and if they're not doing their job and they're not getting it right, it's not a good thing to keep them there forever. It's not good for business. It's not good for the person either. So there were a lot of business principles that in the beginning struck me as a little bit harsh and cold, and although some of them I came to see as perhaps the way to, you know, meaningful, needed. But I will tell you this, when I left to do my own thing, which was going to Pru Re, which became Everest Re, I actually did sit down and say, okay, what are all the good things that I liked about AIG that I think are good for success? And what are the things that I would change? And there certainly were some things that I would change. And I thought part of it was on the human side.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to come back to the Puri transition because it's a fascinating one. I wonder, though, if you remember the first person you had to let go and what kind of guidance you might have been given in that NEAG environment saying, okay, it's Joe's turn. Here we go. Step up to the plate. Here's what you do, Joe.
Well, Puri was a very intense situation in its own right. Let me take a step back and tell you how that formed. Prudential had this organization, and it had been, you know, a failure in terms of profits. It had never made a profit. It had hemorrhaged money year after year. And so they decided they wanted to get rid of it. And the only reason it stayed alive is because the mothership kept putting money into it and finally decided that they didn't want to continue to do that. And so they decided to actually do an IPO and put it out into the market. The trouble was no one in the market would ever buy a company that was losing money hand over fist year after year. So they ended up doing a contract with me. And what was kind of good about that for them was I had a very good track record at Transatlantic in terms of building a company, making it profitable, taking it public, and continuing to have the stock go up because it was doing very well. So the theme on the IPO became to investors, don't look at the past, because the past of Puri doesn't count. Look at my past, and that will be the future. Well, that all sounded very good, but that wasn't really going to happen with the same culture and the same people that had been there doing what they were doing. It was a mutual company. It wasn't even dedicated to making a profit. I think most of the people thought losing a lot of money was a good thing because you were giving policyholders more money back. So when you think about that setting, it was in need of radical change. And frankly, I would say the majority of the people there weren't going to be part of the future that became Everest. Many did adapt, and frankly, everybody was given a chance and an education as to what they needed to do to move into the new world. But I knew from the outset that a lot of people would be fired. And indeed, in just the first 3 to 6 months, quite a large percentage of the Puri people were let go.
Wow. And one of the sad ways that plays out is, you know, when you first turn up that they're scared, right? And so you have to manage the psychology of that, don't you, on a scale?
They were on edge, and for good reason. And at the same time, I was going to be direct and candid about that. There was reason to be on edge. People would not make it in this environment.
Yeah. Why did you do it? I mean, hey, Joe, we got this big money-losing business. I found an old New York Times article when I was doing some research for this that said that Puri at the time was the fifth largest reinsurer in the United States, if I have that right. So although $500 million doesn't seem like a lot these days for a reinsurer, it must have been a significant player at the time. Is that right?
It was a significant player in terms of the amount of business it did. It was also a significant loser in terms of how much it lost every year. So it had some size to it, but it needed an awful lot of change. You know, in our business, volume is the easiest thing to get. Profit is the hardest thing to get. So they don't coincide. I did it because it was really my opportunity to do my own thing. Yes, Transatlantic was public, and yes, I was the president and the CEO. But AIG still owned 49%. It was, very involved. This was a chance to really go out, be the chairman and the CEO, really take the company from the start, build it from nothing, and try to make it into something. It was a tremendous opportunity that Prudential offered to me. They thought I was the right person for the job. Frankly, I thought I was the right person for the job. Even when I came into Transatlantic in 86, Transatlantic had only done business with AIG. So I had to create a whole new company at Transatlantic. I had to take it to the outside world. I had to build a staff. I had to make it profitable. Then I took that one public and kept it going very well.
Why was Trans Re floated? Why did AIG float 50% of that?
Well, AIG owned 49% of Transatlantic back to inception. It had 51% other partners. And candidly, those partners didn't do that well in the beginning of the partnership. I came in 86, and it was a good time to come in. The market was hardening, and I had and it only did business with AIG. So I took it into the outside world. I hired a staff, and by that time, I think the other 51% were looking to get out, and they were going to cash in at a decent return, because now it was a few years of a hard market. They'd get the IPO bounce, and so that 51% wanted to exit. The IPO seemed to be the best way to do that. AIG continued to hold its 49%. It was a great education for me running Transatlantic, because now I was going to be running a public company. I was going to be doing an IPO with the help of Goldman Sachs. I had to worry about the whole company, the taxes, the investments, the ratings, everything that comes with running an entire company. So it was a great, great, great education for me. But in many ways, what I did at Transatlantic was what I had to do at Prudential Re, but it was even at another level where I felt it was more my baby. It was tough to leave Transatlantic Re. I formed a great staff. We were good friends. We were successful. But for me, this was the ultimate, going to Pru Re and Everest Re, and it's proven to be. It's even been more my baby than Transatlantic was by a lot, and it ended up being a great decision.
Now, at Transatlantic, you were I guess at the start, all the business was from AIG. It was partially owned by AIG, and you said they hadn't done so well, so I guess it was pretty good deals for AIG. And so part of that turnaround process would have been giving slightly less good deals to AIG. We've definitely been a part of that, right? So raising rates, that would have put you, I would imagine, in some tension with the AIG organization, who was getting a pretty good ride on Transatlantic's back for a while before that, if I could put it that way, and suddenly you want to stop the train. Was that a tough message to deliver?
Well, yes and no. You're right. It all started with AIG has this good business. Let's share in it as a partnership. It didn't work out as well initially as everyone thought. And in part, that was also because it was the early 80s and late 70s.
Right.
It was a lousy market.
Nobody did well, really.
Nobody did well in that time frame. And that certainly was part of it. But yes, as you got into it, you found, be it as a private company or as a public company, given this connection to AIG in terms of ownership and business, it was complex keeping everyone happy. Mm. The outside partners, later the investors, AIG, and just making sure that it was the right thing, whether it's private or public, in terms of the decisions that you made. So there were some complexities to that. But we worked it out. I mean, you kind of just went to what was the greater good and what is good for investors once we went public, and what's the right thing to do. So there was some navigating in that in those waters. It was cleaner and easier when it was Pru Re and Everest.
Mm-hmm. And so the Prudential mothership put down a pretty significant protection to get the business off its books, right? There's a stop loss there, which eventually you bought the company that written you the stop loss, the Gibraltar Re, I guess it was called. I'd grabbed actually the annual report, the initial annual report that said that I think it was 386 retrocessionaires behind Everest Re at the time when it was taken public. I found that in the notes, and I was just like mind boggled at that. I mean, a lot of that's going to be Lloyd's, I would think, but was there a big tangle of stuff you had to just unwind from older business or some questionable relationships?
There was a lot of history, and there was some question about the history. And you're right, Prudential did put some safeguards in place, some protections in place to help with the IPO. So otherwise, it was a bit of a maze that I think investors would have found unease in getting involved with. And this just made the IPO go a lot smoother.
And how, so you're sitting on a business there now, and it's also the right after Hurricane Andrew and the Northridge earthquake and so significant events in of themselves, asbestos is there, and it's going to come back a few years later in the late 90s, not as bad as it was in the 80s. But how was the environment then? At the time, too, the other point to make, of course, is in the late 90s, it was kind of this legendary soft market, which people many times draw kind of parallels to today, or they have been doing that for a little while now, so I'm not sure how accurate that would be. But what did you try and do to grow that business then? That must have been a pretty tough environment.
It was a challenge. I took over Prairie in 1994. I spent most of the next year reorganizing, hiring, changing the culture. By 95, we were ready for the IPO. We did the IPO. It was 100% IPO. Prudential completely exited. The market in 95 and 96 was nothing great, but as you point out, it got a lot worse. 97, 98, 99, 2000, those were all terrible years. And then you had the World Trade Center. I think really our mindset was to stay out of trouble in those years. We really cut back in our casualty writings. We were always looking for something that we could make a little profit on. There really wasn't much to make a lot of profit on. We were clearly on defense in those years, but that served us well. And when the hard market came after it was ignited by the World Trade Center in 2001, we were quick and happy to take advantage of it, and we really put the pedal to the metal in 2001, 2003, and so forth.
How did you know how much you were going to write then? Because one of the things that's interesting to me about hard markets and soft markets is everybody complains about how you can't make money in a soft market. But when the market turns, they also complain you can't make money, right? But just because the terms have changed, right? So now it's like, oh my God, everything's blowing up. There is no right price. There's a key signal, right?
That was part of what took place then in those severe cycles. You're absolutely right. Things blow up in 2001. And now you have companies that and managements that are just exhausted by the losses and all the troubles that they have to deal with. And they suddenly become convinced in many cases that certain business is unwritable. As you said, you can't get the right rate. Even if rates are up times 10, maybe that's not enough. Let's get back to basic underwriting. Let's cut back the book. They don't recognize just how much change has taken place and is continuing to take place, and they don't do the math and the projection to say now is the time to really do well. In fact, you have a lot – that's what creates the hard market, is so many people saying, I better do less business. I better be exceedingly careful in what I'm writing. And, I think we looked at it completely the other way. This was the time where rates relative to exposure look fantastic, are never going to get better. And so we can do exceedingly well. Let's go for it.
And you made an allusion there to those kinds of hard markets and soft markets. And so the implication there being you think things might be a little bit different now these days. But I'm wondering if you could lay some context out. I mean, how many hard markets do you think you've seen in your career?
Well, I saw the 85, 86 kickoff, and I saw the 2001 and 2002. I mean, there was something going on in perhaps 77, but I was a youngster, and I didn't really appreciate it.
Right.
I wasn't in a management role where I really was part of it. So it really was the one in the 80s and the early 2000s that I've seen, and they were very severe turns, precipitated by horrible results that preceded them, and in the case of 2001, World Trade Center on top of it.
And these days, things might be different, do you think?
I think things are different today. I think companies are much better in measuring what rates should be, involving actuaries with the pricing side of things, having rate monitoring systems, having risk people and risk committees, and having the board involved in terms of where are things at and how much risk should we be taking, much better data to sort through to try to figure things out. So it's not that mistakes won't be made. It's not that money won't be lost. There's also plenty of capital right now in the business, and there's plenty of capital ready to move into the business if it needs the capital. So when you start putting all those things together, it says the cycles will be less severe. They may be pockets of up and down, but the up and down won't be as nearly as severe as what it was in the past.
What do you think about there's an I don't know what you call it, an irony maybe that I observe amongst public company CEOs, and you were one recently, so maybe you can let me know if you think about this, where it is a common complaint to say there's too much capital in the business, and this is causing rates to go down, we can't make money, it's very hard to make money. But people who run companies have the ability to give capital back, and yet none do, right? And so, that you buy shares back, but the scale of that isn't usually enough to really change the marketplace. It's designed to not be, in fact. And so you would love for everybody else to hand their capital back, massive dividend or sell your company or something like that. And some do, I suppose, still. But everybody it's like a prisoner's dilemma sort of game, right? So you want other people to move first and you can hold your capacity and ready to move into the marketplace when it corrects. You know, the competitive nature of the business seems to prevent prevent any kind of market from going any direction other than softer.
Well, I think there's actually been more capital give back than perhaps what you would scope out there. Everest has probably bought back 30% or 40% of its capital in the last 5 years, and we're very happy that we've done that. We bought it back at prices where it's much higher today than what we bought it back at, so it's been good for investors. And the industry has certainly had more in the way of special dividend and capital buyback than it has historically. You're right. People sometimes maybe end up with more than they might need. Although when it comes to ratings and the unforeseen, sometimes a bit more is a good thing to have. I think what I'm referring to is capital flows into the business more quickly than ever, whether it's from hedge funds or pension funds or alternate sources. That's on the sidelines, ready to come in if there's some severe opportunity. That's more what I was referring to, that will limit a severe opportunity, at least going for a long time.
What do you think about one of the stories that I like to tell myself anyway about that capital being much more liquid is that it's really technology enabled. And so many things are. You mentioned the point about measuring rates better, and all these things allow for more remote management of process. So you can get a roll up of the cap modeling of an entire book of business, and an investor can look at that, or a pension fund can look at that and say, here's the portfolio I have. Or you couldn't do something like that 30 or 40 years ago. I'm wondering what you think about, call it, the technological improvements or changes in the business. In particular, I think cap modeling has been a big one, although I think that you're right to point out that even on casualty and monitoring of rates and monitoring what other people are doing in an electronic kind of highly scaled fashion has been incredibly powerful. When did you first notice that things were starting to change? And were you skeptical at first? Because hard market underwriting is hard market underwriting. It doesn't matter what the model says, right? And to a certain degree, they're always wrong. And I think that psychology is maybe retreating a little bit in the face of all this technological advance. What do you think?
Well, I think it's been changing for quite some time. I mean, I look at the last 20, 30 years as it's just been kind of incremental throughout that period, and I think it's a good thing. I think it can be overused. You are right that sometimes models become what's believed to be exact science, and it is far from that. When you get to cap modeling, it's people place a lot of bets on what some of these models predict will happen, and all too often we find out that they're far from accurate. I mean, we can look at models very recently in terms of what happened in Houston and flood losses that just those models are now being updated to include perhaps what they should have beforehand. So I think you still need a certain amount of underwriting judgment. I still think you need a certain amount of common sense. We've always referred to it as upside, downside. I think you still need a certain amount of understanding that models don't embody everything. There's always the unknown. There's always something that you didn't think about. So you have to infuse that into all of this technical advance as well.
And how do you another tension that I think about a bit, and as reinsurers in particular, is it's so hard to know what's going on. I mean, everybody has a model in their head. I mean, you have an informal model as much as you have an underwriting model. The strategic model, one would say, is underwrite when the market's hard and don't so much write business when the market's soft. And that's a model too, in some way. It's hard to define some of those terms sometimes, but it takes a lot of skill and it takes a lot of judgment. And so I think the best firms, and I think Everest is definitely one of these, has a deep kind of culture of collaboration. But this, you know, I find that interesting as perhaps a contrast to the AIG culture that you grew up in, which maybe was more competitive amongst people. What do you think about that observation?
I think you're on the money. I mean, AIG was a different time, and I think AIG and maybe the industry thought the primary purpose was to write business, and even if problems ensued, as you wrote more and more business, you'd work your way out of the problem, you'd still have the more business, and it would just lead on to you growing more business. And so somehow meeting monthly production goals was really the mission. And you're right, at Everest, we have a culture where it's about profit. You have to be very disciplined to do that. A lot of companies talk about it, but they don't do it. It is natural for underwriters to want to write more business, to want to be the biggest writer out there, to want to be king of the mountain, to want to be important to clients and brokers. But at the same time, that has to be constrained by what makes sense and what risk do you want to take and are you getting the right rate. So discipline is it's a vital part of what you need to do, especially in today's world. Furthermore, I think what happened in the 80s and the 70s and even in the early 2000s, where you're going to have this great hard market to bail you out if you get in trouble, well, that's just not the case anymore. You have to figure out ways to make money in today's market. Today's market, to me, there's no hard market coming to bail you out. You have to be better than the pack. You have to watch your expense ratio. You have to have barriers to entry to what you do. You have to be able to do what you do better than most everyone else does it. That's the way to do well in today's world.
At the same time, you do have some kind of growth pressure. Every company will. Every public company will. If you can shrink yourself into oblivion, that can happen and has happened periodically, where a company just isn't doing anything the stock analysts like, and so out they go. So how do you grow if you know the culture needs to be disciplined, because it has to be, because you can blow up. You don't want to do that. So the second worst thing is you know, just sort of atrophy into nothing, I suppose. Like, how do you grow in a marketplace like this?
It can be difficult, but I think you still have the mindset of you clearly want to grow. You're going to look for all the options and alternatives that will allow you to grow. It may mean going into new areas. It may be new investments. It may mean mergers and acquisitions. But you never give up the goal of trying to certainly make it bigger. But at the same time, you're realistic about it. And you're not going to grow into something that's dumb or too risky. And so maybe you have to cut your capital back to keep the ROEs to be good ROEs that you need to have. Maybe you have to go into pausing a little bit longer because there's no great opportunity at this time, but you think there'll be something more down the road, but you continue to look. You have to keep that right mix of trying to move the football down the field and growing, but knowing that in some environments you can do that in a radical way, in a big way, and sometimes you just can't. So you just have to be restrained about it.
I think that there's been a lot of angst about the casualty market in particular, which was super hard and kind of, you know, early 2000s, and has more or less been softening ever since, roughly, right? And there's lots of hand-wringing about, oh, now we can't, you know, I mean, companies have been pulling in and out of that marketplace for 15 years now, right? Always thinking, oh, here's the bottom, can't possibly last longer, the reserve cycle is going to change. And I remember reading those articles that sounded very plausible to me anyway, 5-6 years ago, and nope, that didn't happen. What happened? Like, what didn't happen, I guess, is a better way of asking that question. I mean, how, in what way were you surprised about the market progression since then?
Well, I don't know that I was surprised. I mean, the casualty market, as you said, 10 and 15 years ago, it was a very robust market. It was great. It has had a slow erosion kind of almost every year since then. It has found itself in recent times very thin in terms of profit margin, if any. Why am I not surprised that it didn't change? Well, you know, it wasn't so awful that people were being killed or going out of business or getting big chunks of monies disappearing because of what they had written. Certainly select segments have been. Maybe on the claim side, too, things were a little bit more benign than the world thought it might be. But, yeah, we're kind of at an interesting point right now where it does need to change. Rates do need to go up. And the market, to a degree, needs to correct itself, which is something it's never done just based on logic. It's always been based on fear. And it doesn't have fear going for it right now.
Is there any historical analog? Has there ever been a time like this? Maybe it's the late 90s without 9/11 or something. I mean, what?
I think in some ways it is actually unique. I do think each market has to figure out just what it can do and what can't do. And as I said, to me, it's a new paradigm. To me, it gets back to just doing what you're doing more efficiently and smarter than what the rest of the world is. Because I think if you just do it on average, you're not going to have very good returns.
What would you say would be the point in your career where you first started thinking about sales, about selling things? Because that's when you're a CEO, you're either selling or hiring, more or less. Two big roles you're doing there. When did you first get
it? Well, it wasn't an actuarial. I wasn't selling so much then. Right after actuarial, I went into National Union because I wanted to get into the underwriting side. And I kind of asked Hank Greenberg to put me in a spot where I'd get that education. National Union was the area of AIG that sold directors and officers liability, professional liability. And I went there in 1984. The market was soft as could be, but I was able to be there in 85 and early 86 where the market was changing dramatically. And talk about a change in the world. I mean, I saw the D&O product in 81, 82 where the world thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread because you wrote all this premium and there was you never had a loss. And then by the end of 84, the world thought this is unwritable. Nobody could ever write this product. Let's get out of it. It's not you can't do it at any cost. Claims came in while rates went down. Suddenly in 85, it was changing again. We were getting probably at one point 12 times the rate that we got in 1984. We stepped it up per month. It was January twice, you know, and February three times.
Just trying to find where the market suddenly squeaks.
And every CEO and risk manager was coming in to beg us to write the D&O. We clearly went from very, very soft market to the very, very hard market. But I was still the actuary there, meaning that I was still doing the math. And I was going back and saying, okay, we ran, maybe a 200 combined in 1984. But you know what? If you raise rates 10 times and you kind of change the policy form, I think that makes for a pretty radical change. This is the time to sell. Let's write everything that we can write. So I think I've perhaps appreciated it quite a bit there. And then, as I said, I went into Transatlantic in 1986, and I knew this was the time to really write as much business. Don't get too hung up on the underwriting side. A lot of old school underwriters still wanted to screen a lot of the business and only write 10%. No, it wasn't time to write 10%. It was time to write quite a bit of business.
There was an interesting comment you made there where you said you went to Hank Greenberg and you said, I want a new experience. How did that conversation come about? What were you thinking at the time? You felt, I mean, obviously you had access to him to be able to ask that question and he had the wisdom to grant it to you. But tell me more about that.
Well, it got back to AIG and I think, my desire to grow and fill out. And the fact that I had seen other people before me, including Brian Duperreault, I had mentioned, who had gone on to underwriting at that point in time. And many of us had done well in that area. And you had to have your replacement ready to fill in for you, which I did. But I think it was just part of the broadening out process that was underway at AIG, and Hank was the one responsible largely for that process. So it was a pretty easy conversation, and it worked well. I got 2 years of a great base coding and underwriting at National Union, and so when the job at Transatlantic came along, I was much more ready for it.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get pegged for that job at Transatlantic?
Well, it was the the fellow that was running Transatlantic at the time left to go to another company. And it was a problem. Everything was a problem in 1985. And I was over in London. I was doing something, and Hank called me up and said he wanted me to do that. And typically at AIG, normally it's not much of a conversation. When Hank Greenberg calls you up and wants you to do something, there's only one answer to it. But we did actually talk about it, and I was very pleased to take it on, even though I knew it was a challenge. I will tell you this, it introduced me more to the reinsurance world. I'd been a buyer in National Union, but now I was a seller. And it worked out great because I ended up loving the reinsurance business. It was a whole different world than the insurance side. Suddenly, I think the actuarial side, I could use it a lot more in terms of quantitative analysis because I'm not doing policy by policy. I'm doing thousands of policies. I love the fact that you could do big deals. I love the fact that you could do it with very few people. I love the fact that it was relationship-oriented. Suddenly, everything I'd learned in actuarial underwriting and in the streets of Brooklyn just seemed to work perfectly. And later on, a few years down the road, I mean, Hank did ask me to come back to the insurance side for another task. But I was able to kind of convince him that the best place for me was in the reinsurance.
So you didn't just say yes to that phone call?
No, I didn't just say yes to that one. And that was a little more of a strained conversation, but luckily it went my way.
Yeah, and I don't imagine too many conversations go somebody else's way with Mr. Greenberg. If you don't mind just dwelling on that for a second, he's got this reputation, right, of being a tough guy.
Yeah.
I'm wondering in what ways he misunderstood, because I look at what he built. He might be one of the most successful businessmen of all time, honestly. And so you don't get that way by being this kind of one-dimensional cartoon character, so yelling at people or something. And there must have been, obviously you felt nurtured there in a certain way, although the culture was kind of tough. What does the world not understand about Hank Greenberg?
Well, yes, he was tough. I mean, the world knows that. He was tough as nails. There's no two ways about it. I think most of the world knows that he was brilliant. I don't think that you should be able to look at what he did and achieve without being brilliant. And probably the world knows that he was just dedicated and as hardworking and he expected that of everyone that worked for him. Perhaps what the world doesn't appreciate is he was incredibly perceptive. So, yes, he was very, very demanding. And yes, he was very tough. And you've probably heard of some of the scare stories of how tough. But he wasn't necessarily the same way with everybody. There were some where he thought that was the way to motivate them, right or wrong. And there were other people that I think he realized, you have to treat them a bit differently. They're not going to respond to that kind of in-your-face toughness. They respond to other things. And so actually, I have to say I had a good relationship with him. Many people did have a good relationship with him where he respected to some degree what you wanted to achieve. It had to all work within AIG, and it had to work for him as well as you. But yes, some people actually had conversations with him.
Right. And he hasn't retired and doesn't look like he will. I wonder about what well of motivation just it seems to be bottomless with somebody, like that. And kind of back to the initial conversation we had, what do you think makes somebody tick who just won't stop? Because I think that I can't imagine retiring myself, to be honest with you. I love working, and I find my life gets – I spend more time thinking about, how do I – do more things and continue operating at a high level of quality with all of them, and I just kind of always want to do more, and it seems that maybe Hank also always wants to do more. Do you know what is it?
Well, you're absolutely right. Hank never understood retirement, and even at AIG, when people would get to be 65 or 70 and retire, he just didn't understand it. But he didn't. It's like, how could you? What are you going to do? And yeah. This is so enjoyable. And here we are taking over the world. Isn't that fun? And we had many people at AIG that were 75, 80. We had a couple of people that were mid-90s, and they were still working and very senior people, and he was very happy about that. So you're right. I believe he's going to be 93 in May. I think I have that right. And he's still putting on the suit and tie, going into the office every day and going to Russia and going to China and doing his thing. And he loves it. He just doesn't want to do anything else.
And there is there's meant to be a lot of incentives at AIG to keep people around and lock them in, golden handcuffs and that kind of thing. There was a CV Star entity. I mean, it was a remarkable kind of structure that organization built to keep people there. It must have been tough when you left that for you and for the organization.
Well, I was part of that structure, yes, Star Partnerships, CV Star. It was a unique setup. It was golden handcuffs, if you will, where you could do exceedingly well. But you did have to stay with the company, yep. And you had to stay with the company until you were at least 65. And frankly, at the end of this structure, you left everything on the table if you left before 65. So for someone like myself in their early 40s when I left, it was a long way to go. And I did leave a lot on the table, but I was also going to more, quite honestly.
Sure. Yeah.
And as I said, it was a chance for me to spread my wings and do my own thing the way I thought it should get done. So I just made the decision to leave all that on the table. But it was a unique structure that many people bought into, and many people just spent their careers there.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever hire anybody out of that? I mean, or did you make a break with your past, and did anybody from the old TransRe come and join you eventually at Everest?
I did hire some people from TransRe, and Hank wasn't too pleased about it.
Yeah, right. I bet.
As I used to say, or still say, I said, you know, you don't leave AIG, you defect from AIG, because all of a sudden I was the competition. So we had a strained situation for a while, but ultimately we worked back to a good relationship.
And so, you know, as you're building Everest Re, what were you trying to find? What were you trying to do? Tell me more about that experience when you're hiring people, and what are you looking for, and what's an ideal reinsurance underwriter or, you know, support staff for you?
Well, I'll start with the underwriting side. It's certainly somebody that has some common sense, and it's certainly somebody that can analyze risk. And you have to do it just not only in terms of the rates, that's certainly part of it. So you have to have that quantitative side. But you also have to understand the business of business and what you're underwriting and the terms and the conditions. And you just got to be able to put all that together. And frankly, if you're a reinsurance underwriter, you got to be able to negotiate and talk to people and try to get more to your side of the ledger. At the same time, do it in a way with people that, you know, kind of like you and enjoy dealing with you and feel good about having you on their side and their partner and want to continue to do business with you for a lot of years. So it's a very it's a tough set of criteria that you want for somebody. And we have some great people at Transatlantic, and we have some great people at Everest.
There's also an insurance company. At Everest Re, it was Everest Re, but there was an insurance company, and that's become more prominent more recently. But you know, following your time, what did you use the insurance company for? Is reinsurance primarily, and that's always been my view of the main focus of that organization until, again, a little bit more recently, maybe. How did the insurance company fit into the strategy?
Sure. Well, at Transatlantic, our main focus was exclusively reinsurance. And Transatlantic, which has been continued well by Bob Orlick and Mike Sapner, it continues to be pretty much exclusively reinsurance. Everest, certainly the main focus historically had been reinsurance. But as you note, perhaps 3 or so years ago, we've decided to build a first-class insurance operation. And Dom Edessa, our CEO, hired John Sfino, who's doing just that, and building an excellent organization. But I think getting back to why, it fits in with what I'm saying about cycles and competition and the future of the insurance and reinsurance business. For me, don't depend on some big windfall coming down the road because the market's going to come your way and you're going to realize it and the rest of the world won't and capital won't come in and the world will be your oyster. I think that's a silly way to plan your future. Rather, build companies that are first class, that have first class people, that really have first class strategies and are far better than the average. And if you do that, you'll be a winner in any kind of market. You'll do better in better markets, but that really is what the strategy is in insurance, being highly specialized with highly skilled people and doing it in a way that's among the elite.
Mm-hmm. And you know, growing is always going to be hard in the insurance business, even in that in those circumstances. What would you say is a first-class strategy? Maybe I don't know if you can distinguish that with a second-class strategy. I mean, I'm intrigued by this idea of strategy in our business, only because so much of your – there's not a whole lot of control you can exert, right? Quite a lot of what is there is what's given to you, and so you're kind of picking out what you can observe in the marketplace and trying to just make good decisions. But I don't know if that's strategy so much or if that's just good tactics. I don't know what you think about that distinction.
Well, I think you got to put it all together. I mean, a company is 1,000 different decisions and things that go into it. Just, you know, figure out doing, try to do everything better, and that'll become your strategy. But let's start with something simple like expense ratios. I mean, you certainly don't want a company that's, you want to be streamlined, you want to be efficient, IT has to have its role, but you don't want it bureaucratic. You want to be able to move. There are tremendous differences from one company to the next just there. Well, I would say some have a big competitive advantage over others that really spend where they need to spend and don't spend where they don't need to spend and have the right culture to keep things, as I said, not bureaucratic. But then beyond that, the right people, the right specialties. I mean, some lines of our business that we have are just it's hard to be particularly specialized and different. But other lines of business, I think the quality of the people really makes a huge difference.
Now, one of the things that's definitely happening out there is consolidation is driving larger organizations. And that happened on the reinsurer, insurer, and broker side, for that matter. How do you stay not bureaucratic when you double the size of organization? I mean, Everest will no doubt be much larger in terms of the number of personnel there. There must be some amount of, a feeling of needing to know what they're all doing. And anytime management wants to know something, they must create a bureaucracy to manage, to manage the flow of that information. You can only talk to so many people at once. How do you stay small as you get big?
Well, I think it's very important to stay not bureaucratic. When I took over Prudential Re, we had, I think something like 800 people. And a few months later, we had 450 people.
Wow.
And when I went to the IPO, one of the questions that I would get is, how in the world can you do what you need to do with so many less people? And my answer was, we're going to do 100 times better what we need to do because of the way that we're structured today. We don't have 9 layers that where it has to go up and down the chain to figure out what the answer is to an issue. We don't have countless committees that dwell on things forever. We have a culture that's flat, and flat is good. Flat makes us more efficient. It makes us smarter. It makes us better. And it's just the right people that are handling things. So that's, I think, what you want to be. And yes, as you become a bigger organization, that becomes more challenging to keep that. But I think you always want to keep that at your core.
Was AIG flat?
AIG was remarkably flat. It prided itself on its expense ratio, and it had the lowest expense ratio in the business. And it was incredibly flat for an organization of that size.
And so, obviously, that you're taking inspiration from that experience. Is there some kind of – I wonder about – and you mentioned accountability earlier on as one of the key values of AIG. And again, thinking on this idea of what's the downside of this? I mean, I imagine people must screw up. You know, if you don't have the bureaucracy, I think of as designed to insulate any kind of organization from making mistakes, right? So we're going to put a lot of eyes on this and let the bureaucracy stifle innovation, because it's also going to stifle bad ideas, which a lot of ideas are bad ideas, right? So about more a bad ideas one would think would get through. How do you deal with failure in an organization that's flat with lots of accountability? I mean, accountability suggests you maybe just fire them. I don't know what you think.
Well, no, you're right. I mean, AIG sometimes would go fast and furious, and at times that would work out, and at times that wouldn't work out and had to be fixed, repaired, changed. Perhaps people had to be changed as a result of that. You had to get the whole formula right. It's by no means simple. But I think, you know, for us at Everest, it's wanting to make decisions, not wanting to have committees kill everything and innovation and play everything so safe with non-decisions that's just not the way to run a company. But at the same time, you want intelligent people making intelligent decisions, and even though they may get some of that wrong here and there, you want people that you know are going to get it right most of the time.
So none of that's changing about the marketplace these days, that you need good people making good decisions, of course. And we're kind of running low on time, so I'm wondering if maybe we can suggest what you think is different about that. So what do the intelligent people need to do differently in the coming kind of few years, than they might have over the course of your career, say over the last 10 or 15 years? What's changing?
Oh, I wouldn't know that part has changed so much. I think that still collaborate with people that have a lot to offer and use common sense. I mean, I wouldn't say that part of the world is something that's really changed.
What has changed then? What is different about the environment that we're working in now?
Well, I think I said some of it. You certainly have more data at your fingertips. You have more input to everything. You have sharper competition. You have less cycles that are going to bail you out. You have a lot of things that are different. And recognize that it's different. It's a different game. And you have to be prepared to play this different game differently going forward.
My guest today is Joe Taranto. Joe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's conversation. If you enjoyed it, please leave a rating and comment in iTunes, as it helps others discover the show. Go to webtrough.webtrough.com for the show notes and other content by me. And if you want to join an email list to get notified when the new episode of the Not Unreasonable podcast becomes available, you can sign up at webtrough.com/signup. Thanks again, and speak soon.